Hi, so I am back this week, and to give a bit of context to this week's interview, I suppose, or chat, I'm with an incredible person by the name of PJ Haverty. I'm so thankful to have you here today, PJ. Thanks. PJ is, you're not far from me, you're out the road in Moylach, yeah?
Menlach.
So my podcast and what the whole idea of this is about loss and grief and life in general. Mm. And an awful lot of times I have people on who might have lost someone who died. But I also talk to people who have lost in so many different ways in terms of losing their health or, you know, there's lots of different ways you can have a loss, losing a marriage, all that kind of thing. But for you, I think your story is like the ultimate story of loss because you've lost so much in your from the day you were born and up. And so I thought we might start there. So if we could start with perhaps your mom and she, your birth mother, became pregnant and that's where your story began. So would you like to tell us about your mom and what happened?
Well, as I said, my mother got pregnant and her mother had passed away. So she was only with her father then,
right.
And she was with another sister. And of course, he was an elderly man, and of course, the shame, the panic, and the whole lot.
Mm.
So it was a cousin of my mother's then went down to the priest and told the priest, thinking that the priest would be a great help to her and advise her what to do and all that. So the priest came down to the house then, and everything was quite opposite altogether. But the priest was, he told her to stay indoor.
Wow.
Because she didn't want the other kids around the place or girls around the place, how did she get pregnant? Because back in them days, there was no sex education.
Mm.
They didn't know.
So of course she wasn't married.
And she wasn't married was a big thing as well. And he told her that she was to stay indoor, that she wasn't to go to the church because she was a sinner and she wasn't to go to the church. She wasn't allowed into the church because she was a sinner. And when the baby was due then, it was to be taken to June. Now, from what I got, he brought her to June because he had a care. So her father had to go with her to sign her in.
To the mother and baby home?
Mother and baby home in June.
Mm.
So anyways, when she got there, then father went home and she remained there then for 12 months. So I was born there then. And the only thing she could do for me in the home, what she told me, was to bathe me, to wash me, to feed me. And also changing off nappies. And nappies back in them days were clothed nappies. So the name of my name was on them nappies. She might have about 4 nappies. It was up to her to have them washed and clean every time. And the more thing I'd say that annoyed my mother was that when she was finished with all that, she put the baby back into the cot. Now, the baby was crying. But there was nothing she could do with it. Because the nuns didn't want the bonding between the mother and the baby. So when the mother was to leave the home then, she wouldn't feel it so hard leaving. Because the bonding, they tried to cut out the bonding.
And so they wanted, their goal was to keep the baby.
Keep the baby, wash it, clean it, that's your job, off you go, there's more work to be done. So you can picture a mother washing and cleaning and doing other works and her baby crying and can't do nothing about it. Like, that's shocking, like.
And where were the babies kept? In a nursery?
In a nursery, in cots. That's where they were
just
kept.
Just left there all day?
Just left there, and you cried yourself to sleep. That was it. No bonding. They did not want that bonding. Because it would make it very difficult for the mother to leave. So anyways, after 12 months, then they opened the door and told her she'd have to leave.
And they would keep
So she said, I want to bring the baby with me. And they said, no. You just sign this form here and we'll get him adopted or fostered out, but you're not having him. So she went home to her father then. And a couple of days later, she got a letter from the nuns in June wanting 5 shillings a month offer for the upkeep of her baby in the home. And she wrote down, like she wrote the letter back and said, when I left the home, I was a very sick woman and I wanted to stay there to mind my baby, and I was a very sick woman. But as soon as my health get better, she said, I will go out and I'll get a job and I will pay the 5 shillings. So they wanted 5 shillings paid at the beginning of the month, not the end, but the beginning. So she went back down to Joe and she got a cleaning job in the hospital. And she brought the money up to the nuns and gave it to them every month. Now she was 7 shillings and 6 pence in arrears and she had to pay that as well. So every time she went up, she was asked them, can I see my baby? And they said no.
At the door.
You're not going to see your baby. And that's it. Close the door in her face and that was it. But she didn't give up. She tried hard, very hard. And then finally, then the time she came, then they told her, you don't need to come here anymore. Your baby's gone. He's been fostered out.
Oh my God.
So they warned her then that if she ever found out where I was and if she ever interfered or went to the foster home, that she'd be in big trouble. And of course the girls would be involved. So I'd say I was about 2 years out in the foster home when I was bringing cows in that farm. And I was on the main road. And there was a hill and this car came over. Now, I thought the number plates were a bit strange, but then I found out like it was an English car and somebody that was home visiting a relation of theirs in the hospital got talking to my mother. So persuaded my mother to come to England to look after their elderly couples, like, you know, because they went out to work and that. So I suppose she tried, I don't many times, she came up where I was living, see would she be able to catch me or see me, but she did one evening. And the girl slowed down, of course, the cows blocking the road. And then the lady in the passenger seat rolled the window down and she asked for this certain name that my, where I was fostered. So I told them there's a road to the left here and the house is down at the back. And she kept smiling and I felt awful strange like, and I used to look down on the road and look up again and she was still smiling. And I thought, what's wrong? Did I do something wrong? So as we went down then, I thought they'd follow me down and give out to my foster person. He was dangerous on the road with the cows. But she turned around in the seat and a big smile on her face. And that stuck with me till I met her. And she told me that was her.
Wow. And that
she went to the parish priest and told her story to the parish priest and wanted him to go out and tell the foster parents to hand over her son to her, that she was going to take him to England. And he said, no, you leave him where he is.
What age were you at this stage?
I'd say I was 7 when I came out. I'd be up near 10 or thereabouts. Years
and
of age.
You can remember that moment?
I can remember that. Something that always, I suppose I was kind of frightened thinking, did I do something wrong?
And did she speak to your foster parents at that time?
No, she never came next door near because she was warned to stay away. You see, she couldn't.
She just happened to see you on the road.
She had to go to England then. Oh, and her heart was broken, she says, all the way to England.
So if we go back then to when she was kicked out of the home, you were a baby when she left.
That's right, yeah. I was only a year old.
You were there till what age? 6?
I was there till I was 6 and a half.
And just for listeners who, we get listeners from all over that would have no idea what those homes were. Could you explain a little bit of what was going on in there or do you have any memories of it?
This is an amazing thing. And even as I spoke to other survivors, and they don't have any. And I suppose the reason I think it was a prison. Because when you look out the window, all you're seeing was a high wall all around. There was no love, no care, no nothing. We weren't taught anything. We were just running around, mad little babies running around the place when you did start walking. But there was no love, there was no care, there was no nothing. And our minds didn't develop. And I always say when I came out of the foster home, that's really when I was born. That I could remember them because they showed the love, they showed animals, they showed everything. I seen everything. Because now down there, I didn't see anything. You see nothing. You're just in this big old building. And the only time we ever got out of that building when we went to school in June. And I remember going out because you were outside in and you were walking down the footpath. But then again, the school discriminated against us as well. We had to go 10 minutes late in the morning and leave 10 minutes early in the evening because they didn't want us mixing with the other kids or talking to the other kids. And even during the break in the school, we were cordoned off in a section on the playground that we weren't allowed to mix. And then they had this name on us, Bastards. That was the name we were christened, you could say. And we were marched back into the home again and there again all day long. We knew nothing about Christmas. To think that I was nearly 7 years of age, all excited about this Santa Claus, the Christmas trees and the cards. And to try to explain to me, at 7 years of age, like, you knew nothing.
That never happened.
Never happened. And when they demolished the place, they opened a closet that was there and all the toys fell out that people handed in, but they were never given to us.
Oh, God.
Never given to us.
Do you remember feeling afraid, fear of the nuns?
I had this fear when I came out of the foster home for some reason or another. I was very frightened and afraid. And I remember getting out of the car and it was a neighbour and he's actually Joe McDonough, that the Hurdle for Galway, the famous speech he gave in Crow Park. It was his father that brought me out.
Wow.
Because they were in a rented house one side of me, foster parents. And he had a care and it was he that brought me out. And I was so bad when I said, I can remember holding my foster mother's hand walking out the home.
So your foster mother came to the home. Remember being told someone's going to take you now?
Never.
No memories?
Never. Hadn't a clue. I could have walked out with anyone. That's how bad I was.
Mm.
I never objected or never pulled back. Never. We're so, just clueless. No.
Yeah.
Brain never developed at all. Never.
Wow.
And I remember sitting in the car then. And I was so bad that when the car was moving on the road and that, and when I look out the side window, I thought all the trees and everything was moving. I couldn't connect with the car moving.
Because you'd never been in one.
I was never in one. And when I looked out in and I thought, you know, when you see things flashing, God, I said, you know, they're all moving. So when I came to the foster home, then they all got out and I got out. And next thing I seen this thing coming running. And he kind of barking, making a noise. And I hadn't a clue. And it was a dog. I jumped into the car again. So they were laughing and they were trying to persuade me to get me out. They'd offer work trying to get me out. So eventually they got me out and caught me in to rub the dog and everything, you know. So we went into the house then and everything was fear with me. For some reason or nothing, it was all fear. When I went in the house, you'd look at everything. And there was his sister was living in the house well and she was a big woman as well, like an open fire. And the thing that caught me then was going to bed at night in a small room. Oh, I was scared of it. Absolutely scared of it, isn't it? You know, confined to a small area.
Whereas before, what was it?
It was a big, long room.
And so the room that you were in before that was all loads of beds and loads of children.
Beds down along, yeah. Now, I was afraid going to bed for some reason. And it's only when I met a survivor after that. And he said a man used to come in at night time. And you'd hear him coming. And he used to go round to the beds. And he told me, he said, he was nothing but a Jimmy Savile.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what's the thing done to us. We didn't understand. We don't know.
Mm-hmm. The brain is a good way of blocking a lot of stuff out.
It block out everything. And it's just fear and being frightened. And, you know, I kind of grew up that way in life as well.
So then when did you understand? So you move in with your foster parents and family. When did you come to realise that they, I suppose she wasn't your birth mother? Or did you, was it said?
It didn't seem to bother me.
Yeah.
Like I was just brainless.
Part of the family and that was it.
Just brainless and I was brought into this place and this was it like. And it's only later on in life then that I realised then. My name was different then, you see, that was a big thing.
You had a different name to the rest of them.
So I had a different name. Even myself, my foster mother and father did their best to get my mother to sign because he had a tough time enough, my foster father, because when they were dividing out land, he couldn't get any because he had to have a son.
You have to have a son.
You had to have a son. And then all the farm, all the neighbours around them were all getting land just because they had sons, but he couldn't get it because...
You weren't seen as his son.
I wasn't seen as son. I was only a walk hand. That's all I was there on the farm.
That's what society would have seen you as, is it?
That's what they were seeing you as.
And was that a thing where people did foster in children to have them as...
Has them have workers there.
Slaves, basically.
Yeah, so you know, they could send their own kids to college and that, didn't you see? He went out to big landlords, big well-to-do people. And the same with the girls would have gone out into houses, big houses for cleaning and all that.
So was that the idea behind... I suppose the nuns were getting paid to give them children to help on the farms and things.
Oh, they were, because later in life, I asked my foster mother, I said, how much money did you give the nuns for me?
Yeah.
I asked her straight up and yeah. I said, how much money? And she said, I'll tell you later. which she never did.
So they had to pay for you.
So they had to pay. And they were delighted in a way, like, because she was anxious to have a family.
Yeah.
And you see, I was very lucky. You see, my foster parents went to England. They went to Manchester. And they worked in Manchester and they got married in Manchester. So when they came back here then, they weren't afraid of the priest or nobody.
Mm.
Even a cell, they did all the Christian duties in England. They went to Mass, they went to everything. But when she came back here, they were so far forward. Mm-hmm. Than the Irish here, because they were kept down by the church again and the priest and, you know, and all that. Now, she did respect the priest and everything, but she stood her ground with her and she gave her own opinion. So she did.
Fair play. And so when you joined that family, were you the only child?
No, they adopted a girl then.
Okay. And so what was life like growing up in that family? Did you feel the love and the warmth?
Oh, I did, felt everything in the whole lot. And, like, you know, it was great, like, you know, that... You had the freedom to move. The animals was a big thing for me.
Mm.
Going out to animals and feeding them and everything, like, that was a big thing. Me mad to get out.
You loved it?
I loved it. And they had cows and they had everything. And, oh, I loved it. Really loved it. So I did. And then they adopted a girl then, and she was about 3 years of age. Then they adopted, they fostered another lad then as well, but he was already out in a foster home.
Mm.
And it was a teacher in a vocational school that... kind of looking at him and everything, and he felt there's something not right with that young lad. There's something not right, because, like, he didn't seem to have enough of food coming in, his clothes were dirty and he wasn't. So they notified the help board then. So they went out to the house where he was, and sure, your man was very fond of the drink, the foster father, and he wasn't looked after or nothing.
Mm.
So then they came along, did to my foster parent and asked him would they take him in. He was 3 years older than me, like.
Mm.
So they took him in. So he went on to be a chef, and he's living in London now. He's retired.
But he grew up, they kept him permanently. So
all three of us grew up together then.
Wow.
It was timed in to, as I say, spread the wings. And so we got on as a family. We, you know, we're still in touch. My adopted, she's in the home house. And
so then I suppose... when you spread your wings then and you left the foster home.
I didn't actually leave the foster home. I stayed there.
You stayed there, lovely.
Working on the farm, and then I went for to be a motor mechanic then.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
And so when time passes and you begin to look back, when do you start to think, I would like to meet my mother, or how did that come about?
The thing that came about was my own foster mother, believe it or not.
Mm.
She wanted me to meet my foster mother. Unbelievable.
And what did she say to you?
You see, a health nurse used to call to the house every so often.
Okay.
While I was, till I came 17 or 18, just to see that you were okay and all this. And she was kind of at her and at her, like, when I came into my late teens. So she said, like, she'd lose her job if she was to give any information. So she said, no, she said, I will promise you one thing, I will not open my mouth. So all she did then was left the address where my mother came from. So a couple of years later then, when I was there to get an old bang out of a care, I went up to where my mother then was born.
Wow. Tell me about that day.
Well, I went up and I was inquiring, and you'd meet people and everything, and they said, nah, there's no Havertys up here. Down again, wait a couple of months or a year later, back up again. And just a bit of luck, I met a man on a bike. And I asked him, I said, is there any Havertys around here? No, he said, but there was, he said. And one of them got into a family with trouble, you know, got pregnant, he said. A lovely woman. And she disappeared and we never seen her again.
God.
So he told me where the house was. And I went up to the house, it was all demolished. It was all because her father was dead at the time. And he said, I'll tell you another thing now. He said, her sister is married to one of the most contrarian men in Ireland. And he said, I will not go down with you. So he told me where the house was. So I was kind of, will I or won't I go into the house or not? So anyways, I knocked on the door and the woman opened it, and she just about opened it. I said she was afraid of the husband inside. So anyways, she kind of gave a jump, and I knew then she kind of recognized me in some way or form, the look she gave. So he came out then and opened the door fully. And the language, my God. So I told him, sorry, I came to the wrong house. And how could you come with the language out of him? So I went and left. So a couple of weeks later then, we got a letter from my mother then. My aunt. That was my aunt.
And she had
contacted. She wrote a letter
to my... Did you tell them that day who you were?
I didn't, no. I just went off again because I was afraid of him.
But she just knew it was you?
She knew whatever.
Wow.
And I was afraid to say anything. And I said, sorry, I came to the wrong house. So after that, then we got a letter from my mother. She was in Brixton.
To the house?
To my foster mother, got a letter from my mother then. It was my foster mother like that opened it and told her how PJ, how her sister had wrote a letter to her. And she thought, that was PJ is looking for you. She, that's where, whatever way she had down the letter, he was looking for you and all this and everything. And that's how the whole ball started rolling then.
Oh my God.
You know, and it was her husband. She got married, but she had no family. And it was he that persuaded her to write a letter to my foster mother.
Wow.
And that we would love to meet.
And what age were you at this stage?
I was in my 20s, I say, at the time.
Right.
Early 20s. So anyways, it was back in 1977 then.
Okay.
And of course, my mother was, she travelled there too if she got here, and she wouldn't bother her where she went to. So we decided we'd go and meet her then, back in 1977.
Wow.
So myself and herself then took off then for the boat and went to Liverpool, and she knew the way down to Manchester. She had another sister in Manchester and a husband there as well. And her husband had a cousin in London. So we hit it off with the car. Me thinking this was great on the motorway and everything. It was the worst thing I ever did because I got totally lost on the motorway. Sure, I never seen a motorway in my life. Only narrow roads here and all that.
Yeah.
So eventually we had to make contact with her in London because there was no mobile phones.
Yeah, how did you find her?
They went into a phone box and went and rang for her to come out to meet us. And we were totally lost, I don't know, way down, somewhere down towards London. when I look back again, thanks be to God I had no brains or no nothing. She came out and she met us then.
Wow.
And she brought us to her place. He hired his apartment. Well, I was so frightened because of the traffic.
Okay.
Being lost. I couldn't concentrate on anything. Even my mother, I couldn't concentrate on nothing.
Yeah, you were panicked.
And thinking, and the worst thing for me was when I came to traffic lights and seen the sign, I was in the wrong lane and pull across, and there was the Englishman. Bloody old Paddy, and he blown the horn at me.
Yeah.
And I thought I'd be arrested. The report of the police, this is a lunatic in an Irish car. And the worst thing about that time, that was the time the bombings.
Yeah.
What on earth brought us over and the bombs?
I know.
So we stopped in her place that night then, and she said, I know my way down to Brixton. And so Brixton was no distance.
Yeah.
We sat in the car the following day. We drove around London, I know, many times. At the finish up then, my foster mother and her sister had to go into a police station in London looking for directions. And when I look back again, you'd swear now, like it was like going into Athenry, looking the road down to Monabay or something.
Yeah.
Looking for Brixton, like.
Yeah.
And he trying to explain to them. So when they were coming out then, they went out the wrong door. And he shouted at them. He said, come back, you're going out the wrong door. And I wish you all the best getting to Brixton. I think it was nearly 2 o'clock that night when we got to Brixton. And we should have been there in the morning.
God.
So when we arrived then, my mother and her husband were out in the footpath. There was a roof area enough now that a family living over top, and then another, she was living in the bottom. So anyways, got out of the car and gave her a big hug and the chicken, kiss on the cheek and shook hands to her and everything. But she was so nervous, she was afraid to open her mouth.
Oh, the poor thing.
And I think she was afraid that I was going to rear up on her for leaving her there and everything.
Yeah.
So we went in with the tea and all, and she had a bed made for me. But I couldn't stay because we had to go back to one's place again. I had the care.
Yeah.
And somebody said it was a pity she'd have told you about June. And then somebody else said, no, it might be better not to know.
Yeah.
It could affect you right through life what they did in there.
Yeah.
You're better off to know what you know now. You met her and all that. So after that then we got one or two letters, my foster mother then, and thanking them for looking after me and all the whole lot. Everything kind of stopped then for a while.
Did she say anything to you at all? Did she say, sorry to have left you or anything like
that? Well, she did. She said she was sorry and she did her best to get me out of there. And the nuns wouldn't allow it and they wanted me to sign and I wouldn't sign because I always thought the day will come that I'll have you, that I'll be able to take you out of there.
That's huge, isn't
it? It's huge. My heart went out to her. And only for the husband, he was a gentleman. So next thing, things stopped, then no letters coming. So my first foster mother said, she's happy now that you're looked after and she wants you to get on with life.
Mm.
So years later, all of a sudden, letters started coming again.
Right.
Her husband had passed away about 2 years after we meeting him.
Oh.
And she said she didn't think she had a right to interfere in my life, Hunter said. She hadn't the thing. So then my foster parents and my foster mother fell into bad health. And like my foster mother was a mother to me. Like it's a sad thing to say, my real mother brought me into the world. But there was no connection, no nothing. It was sad. Like, I mean, I hope I'm not speaking out of.
No, I totally understand way. That. Yeah.
And that broke my heart as well. Like, as she brought me into the world.
Yeah.
And she loved me. But you could say my foster mother then took over.
Yeah, she was your mom then.
Like. She took over and like she looked after me as my mother would look after me and that, like, you know. And that kind of broke my heart a bit as well then. Because when my foster mother got bad then, I was heartbroken because she had, her heart was very poor and all that. Then she passed away.
Oh, God.
And then my foster father couldn't live without her and he passed away a year and a half after her.
God, PJ.
And he got bed one night and he was staying with Mary, she was adopted and she moved in herself and the husband. And he was feeling awful bad and everything, so we went down and I was only living next door. So we rang the ambulance then. So they came out and he had the thing around him and he was shaking. So I said to him then, I said, the ambulance is here now. You better put on your jacket. He got up himself, put the jacket on him, went up to the mirror and did that with the hair. And he said, I'm off to see Teresa now. That was my foster mother's name. I'm off to see her. And he died in hospital. He died of a broken heart. He wanted to be with her.
Wow.
So he did. So then when they passed away, then my wife then decided what we'll do, then we'll go back. And we see, can we locate, is your mother still in the same place? So we flew over then and the following day then, we stopped overnight then in the Travelodge in London and we got the train down. The wife was used to the underground train because she was had relations down there. So I said to her, now what we do? I said, we'll walk on the opposite side in case she looks out the window and see two strangers. She might. So luck was with us on the day. We walked on the opposite side and next thing we came down to number 17. Never forget it. And there was my mother in a tiny little wall. Just around the little. So anyways, we crossed the road over to her then and it was a beautiful day. And she said, oh, hello, you're looking for the new neighbours that moved in next door. So the postman came then in the meantime. So I kind of backed off a bit and the wife said, what are you going to do? And I said, God, I said, if I tell her who I am, she could drop dead with a heart attack. Like, you know, I was afraid. So I don't know, something clicked in my mind and I said, look it. If I go home and next thing found out, she said, I kicked myself and not saying something. So I went back up to her when the postman left. And I said, it may be you I'm looking for. Do you know who I am? She said, I did. I knew you crossing the street. She said, why do you think I'm leaning on the wall here? She said, the power's gone from my two legs. So my wife was working in Maryland Park. She was a health nurse in there and she came up then and got talking and talking. And next thing she came around then. So eventually then we went down to the restaurant then. And while she was sitting across the table from me and she was staring me in the eyes and that smile on her face. And that was the same smile I was bringing in the cows. I could remember, I could know it. And she didn't. That is a fact. So I was going to ask her about June then and I thought I won't because that's what she think we came back for.
Yeah.
Want to know about June, not her. So we told her about her grandkids and we'll organise next year to bring the grandkids over and she can meet with them. So anyways, myself and the wife went over the following year after that then and cockies, you're like, thinking there'd be no problem here. We went to the house, knocked on the door, no answer. And it was a Sunday evening. So we decided then we'd go down to the church because she was always talking about the church in the letter. So we went down into the church and we seen that there was mass at 6 o'clock in the evening. So myself and the wife just waited around the church and we were watching young lads on skateboards and that. And my wife said, your mother's coming down the footpath. So we crossed the road over to her. So I said, how are your mother? And she said, get out of my way and let me go to church. I said, I'm PJ, I'm your son. I'm no son. Get out and leave me alone, let me go to church. She was gone, I'd say. So we let her off to the church then. And but my wife, quick thinking of my wife, she said, what we'll do is, she said, when Mass is over, we leave a number, phone number to the priest. But we'll tell him we're a distant relation in case she didn't say anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Good job we did that. So we left the number with her. And then shortly after that, then I said, not too long after that, then I got a phone call from the health board or the social welfare over there and asked me, was I PJ Haverty? And I said, I was. Have you a mother here? I said, I have. That's right, yeah. Well, she said, I said, no, she passed away last night. So anyways, I had to go over then, of course, to prove who I was. I had to go to court over there. Well, it was only in front of a judge.
Yeah.
So I had to get all my paperwork done here with the solicitor. And I had to go over then. So myself and the wife went over then and to prove who I was. So the hospital were in contact. And what confused the hospital was she told them that she had no family.
Mm-hmm.
And she must have known that she was going to die or something. And she told the nurse that night, if I should pass away, she said, will you make contact with my son in Ireland? And the nurse said, you don't have any. We have your records here. Oh, I have. I have a son. And she was there to tell. So they made contact in with the social workers.
In Ireland?
In England.
Yeah.
And they said, no, we'd have known if she had a son. No. So she said, look, we'll get on to the church. We find out from the church. So we rang the church then. And a lovely priest, a down-to-earth, a right gentleman. And he helped us in so much way. And he was Father Heavey from Cork, was the name of the priest. So he said, give me time, he says. So he went down and he got the phone number. And he rang it back to the social worker then. So that's how they made contact with me.
Wow. And if you didn't give that number?
If we didn't, she was gone. We wouldn't have known anything.
Wow.
So it was lovely then to be able to go to her funeral.
Oh.
Went over to her funeral. But all her friends were so heartbroken. The priest was heartbroken. And they said, why did she not tell us she had a son and we would have to help her? Well, I said, the way it is now, Father, when she got pregnant in Ireland, the priest came and that's one thing he told her, not to go into a church, that she was a sinner. And this church meant so much to her that she was afraid that you put her outside the door. Well, he said, I wouldn't have done that when they did in Ireland. And she wasn't taking that chance because the church meant so much to her. And that's what kept her going in life. Was in there cleaning and make sure that everything was okay. So then we used to send her, when my foster parents passed away, then we used to send her flowers for her birthday. And the priest said to me, he said, did you send flowers to her? I said, I did. And do you know where them flowers used to go? He said, outside the statue of the Blessed Virgin.
Oh, God.
And that water he changed was changed every second day, he said, and fresh water put in.
Wow.
You know, so.
So she never, that never left her, the whole
it was
secrecy of keep this to yourself and don't tell anyone.
Don't tell anyone.
That you have a son, like.
That you had a son because she thought.
Until she was on her deathbed and she said.
On her deathbed she told the nurse.
Wow.
And she didn't want anyone to know because she thought that church, she'd be outside that door, that church.
You know, when I think of all the moms, you know, we in Ireland know the history. And being a mom myself, I just wonder what, not alone what you went through, which we'll get to. But for a mother to have to, their child taken off them, like what that must have been like for her, mother
and,
of God.
And thinking of that child every single day of her life.
Yeah.
It must have broke. I say, you know, we criticize the church so much and everything, the whole lot of it, but it was the church that kept her going.
Yeah.
She believed in so much in the Blessed Virgin. As I said in one interview before, I said the Blessed Virgin became her mother and kept her going in life.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way I can see it.
Yeah.
it had meant so much to her. And then amazing thing there, like we were over, we put a headstone up as well in our thing because my own family in time. And the amazing thing, she's buried one side of a priest.
Is she?
She is.
Wow.
We thought this was... So, yeah, it was very heartbroken. Even myself.
Yes, when she died.
It was more or less anger in me.
Okay.
Through life, what was done to her.
Mm.
And to think, like, should I have done something? Could I have done something? I just don't know because of my foster parents, then it was hard to make a decision what, because they were so good to me and my foster mother was so good to me. Without her, I wouldn't have met my mother, like.
Mm-hmm.
And you were caught between, it was very hard.
You didn't want to hurt them.
I didn't want to hurt them either, like, you know, and you had no help, like, there was no one there to advise you in them times, like, you know, that could.
Yeah.
That was it. And then as well as that, like, money wasn't plentiful in them days.
Yeah, I know.
I did. I went to build a house then, and then I had a mortgage, and it wasn't easy, and it was expensive going to England. So it was.
Yeah, going over and back.
Going over and back, like, you know, so. But as lots of people said, look, you're a very lucky man. You got to meet her. You got to talk to her. You got to hug her. You got to go to her funeral.
I know.
You're a very lucky, lucky man.
Well.
That's what they say, like, you know, that
you're
didn't.
You're lucky in that part.
Part, yeah.
But, you know. Because all I would say is for the people who don't get to meet their mother,
it's a huge
unanswered question. It's something they have to deal with, but you still have a world of pain to deal with. You know what I mean?
Regardless. And as I said, I will bring that anger to my grave with me.
So do you feel angry now always?
I still feel angry all the time when I hear stories of other people. It makes me angry. And to read up about the mothers, and I even met mothers. And to think, like, it's like there's a mother out there, she's 93 years of age. And she was taken into Galway Hospital from June. And she had her baby, and they came back 5 minutes later. Her baby's dead. The next thing, they took her down to June. And to this day, she's still looking for that baby of hers, wanting to know, where is it? If it died, where did they lay it to rest? Where? That's all she wants to know. It's like another woman that said, all I want to do is meet my son, just to hug him, to know that he's alive and he's well and he's looked after. And I'd be happy.
So
that's what you had out.
So these homes, for listeners, I suppose, in Ireland, it was very much the power belonged to the Catholic Church.
Very much so.
Mm. And they had schools, institutional schools, is that what you called them? Industrial schools.
You had it out in Connemara and all these places. And
across the country.
Right across the country.
And so Tuam made headlines for numerous reasons.
Yes.
But there was one in Tuam where I'm 10 minutes, that's where I come from, 10 minutes down the road.
Road, yeah.
You, the same. That's where you started your life.
Life, yeah.
And... you know, for someone who has no idea, what happened in these schools in general? They were run by nuns. They took in unmarried mothers.
Yes,
mostly?
Yeah.
Or was it, would they take in, let's say, unruly people who weren't pregnant? Or was it all pregnant mothers?
Oh, did all pregnant mothers.
Okay, all pregnant mothers.
And another thing that was annoying then is the rich people's daughter that got pregnant were taken in at night time, had their babies in it, and then walked back out and no one knew anything.
With the babies?
No, to give the babies up for adoption.
So in Ireland at that time, if you had a baby out of wedlock, you couldn't keep it.
You could not keep it. And that's the thing that annoyed me when the government set up the Commissioner of Investigation and I went up to Dublin and the three of them were there and not a smile on their face. No welcome, no nothing. And I told them part of my story, how I met my mother. I had no file. I didn't have that file. And they came along then and made a statement saying, that when the mothers left them home, they had the choice of putting the baby up for adoption or taking the babies. And I said, like, that was 100% of a lie.
Yeah, not true.
Because my mother...
begged for you.
Begged for me. And I told them that. And then they had the cheek. But then again, when you see who picked them, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, picked these three. So
they're of the opinion that... None of these mothers wanted their babies.
Wanted the baby, yeah.
Well,
it's,
that's insane.
It's saying,
what mother doesn't want her baby?
Well, that's it, like. And
there is some, I'm sure, but...
Well, you see, there was younger ones that went in there, 16, 17, 18, hadn't a clue about babies, having babies, nothing.
And so, going back to, I suppose, the whole point of these schools, it was a school, but the nurses delivered the babies.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the mothers had no pain relief, no nothing. That was the way it was back then.
It wasn't a thing. Nothing.
They took the baby instantly off them and said,
off them,
and then get to work for us.
You had to work for them because they had the hospital and they had to do all the washing for the hospital.
And so that's what the young mothers
had
to do.
They'd wash the sheets and clothes. That's what all the mothers was at. And then the alone, then, as my mother was saying, when they were potty training the kids, they were all sitting on pots. Some of them could sit there all day, some of them move, and that's when the kidneys and bowels worked. And they would be called up to clean the floor. Not alone clean the floor, but go down and scrub it as well.
So that when the children were...
When the potty training.
But who would be doing that? Was the mothers allowed to do that?
It was all mothers, different mothers, whoever.
Yeah, so they'd say, get in there now and train that child.
Sit in the pot and everything, go off and then and everything, unless maybe later on the baby or the thing would move away.
Yeah.
Altogether crawled off and then...
You were to clean it.
Then the floor, maybe that's when the bowels and the kidneys worked and
yeah.
They had to scrub it, down the knee scrubbing as well. They were just, like, you look at the laundry in Galway, like, that was a total prison.
Magdalen Laundries.
Young girls put in there working 6 days a week.
And did they have the babies as well?
No, they had babies.
Yeah.
But the babies were gone to America.
Okay, so they sold them off.
They were sold off. They were put up into the laundry here in Galway.
Again, all women who had babies.
All women that had big babies and locked in there, working as slaves every day, doing all the washing for all the hospitals and everything, the whole lot. They worked as slaves.
Would some of them come in when they were heavily pregnant and probably had to work?
They would have to work till the baby and...
Till the baby was born.
Till the baby was born, yeah.
There was no such thing as, this woman is heavily pregnant, let's look after her.
Oh, we leave her in, look after her. Do you want tea? Do you want your dinner? No.
And so
it was a punishment in a sense as well, like.
Yes.
For having the baby, a punishment.
So very much we know that the church and the priests would very much be involved in the decision of get that child, that young woman out of here. She's a disgrace.
That's it, yeah. And another thing as well, what they did, if you say the younger mothers, say 15, 16, 17 years of age, and the big thing in there was breastfeeding.
Mm.
It saved trouble buying milk.
Yeah.
And sometimes what they do then, like these young girls hadn't a clue. So what they do, they would put that young mother and a baby in a room and lock the door. And can you imagine she crying, the baby crying?
Yeah, they didn't know
what to do. One trying to break the other. And some of them were actually sent to Bandislaw, St. Bridget's and Bandislaw.
To the mental hospital.
Mental hospital, and some of them never got out of there. That's how cruel. They were making them pay for the what's called sins. And there was daddy gone off.
No word.
The priest didn't follow the daddy and say, you're not going into this church. You stand by this woman. And I met a woman a couple of years back and I was looking for directions again because my mother were kind of a bog road in and there's a lot of roads and so just attached house. And I said, I'll go in here. They'll know the direction to my mother's house again. So anyways, she brought me in, made the tea and she see me on television, of course. So she was telling me back in 1957, the ESP put in. That's when the ESP were put into the houses. And there was a big storm and the cable came down on her sister's house, came down. And her sister went out to clean up the yard and caught the cable, not realizing. So she was electrocuted. So when they brought the remains to the church then, her daughter was pregnant. And the priest came out and said to the daughter, by right, he said, you shouldn't be allowed into this church. But because of your mother and the remains here, I allow you in, but you will not receive the Blessed Sacrament. He stood by her, the boyfriend, and a couple of years later then they wanted to get married and they went to him. And he said, they cannot be married in the church, but they can be married in a room adjacent to the church.
Wow.
It's like me, I couldn't serve Mass. And neither. I couldn't go inside the altar rails.
You weren't allowed?
So I couldn't serve Mass. And neither.
Because
I was born out of wedlock. Couldn't serve Mass.
Could you receive communion?
I could receive communion and all that, everything else. But
you had the sacrament of, you know, your first Holy Communion, yeah, confirmation, I did, yeah, all that.
But I could not serve Mass.
So, oh. So do you remember that feeling like so different?
Well, I did, because like the lads that I was in school with, like they were serving Mass and I was down, like, you know, and, you know, it was kind of...
Isolated.
You just felt isolated, like, you know. So,
just on the schools and these industries and the laundries and all of that, we know that abuse was a big thing. That was a big thing amongst the mothers and the children.
And all was abused, and like
physical, sexual, you name it, the whole
you
lot.
You name it, Connemara. Like, as I said before, a couple came back from America there a couple of years ago. Because I spoke to the teacher that was out in Letterfrack, because it was part of GMIT.
Mm.
And they were doing the fancy woodwork, carving and all that thing, and they opened up a section of it. And there was another section they didn't renovate it, they didn't do anything with it. And he told me that a couple came from America, an elderly couple came from America. And he said, he asked the teacher, he was just coming back to Galway. And he asked the teacher, and he said, is this place fully renovated? And the teacher says, no, the toilets and everything are still the same. Can I go in to see it? And he said, I have to get back to Galway now with the traffic. So he explained to him then. He said, I was actually in this place, he said. And this is my wife. And I told her my story. And he said, that's why I want to show her the toilets down there and that. So he said, okay, opened it and went down. And apparently there was a bear across. And you were naked going into the shower. And if the Christian brothers fancied you then, you were in big trouble. He said, they did what they want to me, he says. And I couldn't do anything about it. So he said, it finished up, the three of us were crying.
Oh, God.
Finished up, we're crying. There's another book out now, and there's a family from Ballinasloe back in the 1922.
Mm.
And the mother was very, very sick again, and they were in an old shack of a house, nearly falling apart, and she was pregnant again. So like that. The priest, the social worker, the guard, the whole lot came. And they put them on a train to Clifton. And they were picked up by the Christian brothers. So anyways, there's a book out about the story. So it was quite funny in one way, because when they were in there, like, they were beaten and sexually abused and all. So there was a tailor in it. So this young lad from Ballinasloe said to the Christian brother, can I go in there? I like to be at a stitch and, you know, and all that. So the Christian brother asked the tailor, and he says, no problem. So he went in, and the only reason he wanted to go in was to stitch extra material inside his pants. So when he got the wallop in the backside, he wouldn't feel it as much. So when he left that place, when he left that place, then he went to England. And he joined the Scottish Regiment. And he fought in World War I. So he came back then totally depressed and the whole lot. And he could see the Irish, like, were coming over. And they were kind of going in drinking and all this stuff and living rough. And so anyways, he was trying to persuade them. So apparently he got so depressed that he got petrol. And he poured it on himself. And he set fire to himself out in Hampstead in London. And burned himself. And the only way they got to find out about him was the jacket didn't burn fully. And there was a little card inside it. And apparently they traced it back to Dublin. It took about 12 months. And there was a book. I think it was Smithfields or somebody like the name of that or something.
Mm.
That used to sell and write books.
Mm.
And he was sending the story back to them.
Okay.
About his life.
Wow.
And I got the book down. Somebody else has it at the moment.
That's the damage that was done.
That was the damage that was done.
And so in Tuam, in the 70s, wasn't it? The late 70s? Am I right in saying there was two boys playing?
So 72.
So 1972.
Yeah.
There was two young boys playing in the...
Actually, they went over the wall. They were outside.
Okay.
And they climbed over because...
Of the school that you were in?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because it was all demolished at that
stage. So it closed down then?
It closed down in 1961 and then it was demolished then.
Okay, and so what happened?
They climbed over the wall then and there was an apple tree inside. So they went up and they seen the slab split in two and they pulled it back and they could see all the skulls and all the bones and everything in it.
In a slurry tank?
A slurry tank in the corner, and they closed the lid again and went out and of course told the parents and everything, the whole thing, whole big thing around June. All of a sudden then, hush, hush. Don't go around talking like that, there's nothing. Next thing the council came in then and they put soil all over the lot of it. Covered the lot of it. As one would say, covered history. What went on?
So they made a discovery of
and the girls knew
remains.
About it. They all knew about it. They all knew.
And nothing was done?
Nothing. Just cover it over and leave it.
So that would tell you that there was society, people in power knew that there was babies dying
and, knew babies
and just being
be.
Thrown into the back garden or wherever and no one cared.
No one cared because the mother was gone. There was no one coming looking for them. Nobody wanted them. The files were all locked up. There's nothing.
So there's no one regulating the whole nuns?
Nothing regulating the thing at all. They just died whatever from diseases or whatever they neglect or whatever they died from. And I wouldn't mind, but the main cemetery is across the road. That's what annoys me so much, that they couldn't take in a small piece of ground there and lay them to rest there and put up kind of some plaque with the names who's laid to rest here. And we met the new bishop in June, Bishop Duffy, a gentleman. That's the way I describe him. And there was a fuse down there that day and I put a notice up on the wall, babies beneath my feet. So we got talking to him anyways and he said, ring my secretary. He said, I'd like to talk with you. So myself and Walter went down. We spent 2 hours with him. And he said, ignore me now. Pretend I'm not a bishop at all. He said, I've seen documentaries and just open up to me. He said, I like to hear it coming from a survivors. We just opened it up. So in the meantime, then he took the phone out of his pocket and he said, I was deeply upset, he said, down in June when I seen what was up on the wall. Babies beneath my feet. Oh, I said, I'm awful sorry. I said, I put that up there. No, don't be sorry. That's when I realised I was walking on the dead. And he said, you should never, ever walk on the dead. Show respect. And that's what hurt me. And he said, something should be done about this. A lovely man. And he said, my door is opened. Just make a call to my secretary and make an appointment and my door is open. The bishop before that, good day, wouldn't open the door.
Didn't want to speak to you?
Didn't want, not way.
Have you ever contacted the nuns, that organisation?
We contacted them, wrote to them, wanted to meet with them, sit down to talk to them because we knew the people that did that were dead and gone.
Yeah.
But the order was still there.
And?
No. They appointed people to meet with us. But I wasn't accepting that. Like I met this woman in June that was appointed by the nuns. And went into office to her and all she kept on saying, but look at the life you have now. Just think about the life you have now. And I said, no. I said, I want to meet the Bon Secours nuns, the head of Bon Secours nuns. I want to meet her face to face and apologise to me to my face what they did to my mother and what they did to me. I said, that's all I want. And she kept on. So eventually I walked out. I says, pointless talking to you. I says,
They refuse
to this day. They refuse. They even refuse to give, they haven't given any
statement like
money towards the redress scheme around that.
So tell us then about what happened then with Catherine Corliss got involved and the babies. Was that exhumed? What happened there?
Catherine then got involved. There was a group of women down there and they used to keep the place tidy, the grass. They put up a statue of Our Lady and all in it. So Catherine wanted something to do in life and she went into the Shum Herald and she seen about the babies. Now she herself knew, herself, that there was a home there and there was babies there because they used to come to school and she was going to the same school. So anyways, a wonderful lady, no question about her, and her husband and family, fantastic. So I remember then I seen on the paper where they were fundraising for to upgrade the ground down there and all that, so I went down. So I told them who I was and everything. So they gave me what you call it. And I went around to different houses that I knew people would give money towards. Mm-hmm. And I collected so much and I went down with it. So when I went down then, RTE were down there, radio. And Catherine was there and the whole lot. And that was the first time to meet Catherine. And some woman said, this man here was in the home in June. So Catherine came up to me then and we got talking. So she said, RTE One Radio is here. And she said, would you talk to them? And I said, Catherine, Jesus. No way, I saw never talk. And it was only a phone, my phone. So she persuaded me then. She said, look, PJ, you did nothing wrong in life. And she said, go out there and tell your story and keep your head up. It's not your fault what was done to you. And tell your story. So I went into the room with your man then and interviewed a couple of minutes with him. And that's when the ball started rolling in about the babies. The world media got to know about it. She went into Galway then and she was looking for dirt. So it was through the Tuam Herald archives.
Yeah.
That's where it all started.
Yeah.
That she seen about this home. And how those babies found, buried down there. So she started the ball rolling, as you could say.
Mm.
And she went into the death and marriage thing there. That's the one about the death certs for the babies in June. And the one went in and came back out. And she said, how many do you want? She just got that. Couldn't believe it. And it was 796.
Babies registered that died in the home.
And as far as I know, I think there was... Was it 8 mothers? And I think she had a death cert for 4 of them. So where are they?
They have no graves.
Which she doesn't know.
There's death certs for 8 women, but there's no...
Oh, they're buried across the road in no man's and just... that was
no it. Plaque over them. They no don't know where they are.
No, don't know where they are. So that's when the world media started the ball rolling and came to us and were interviewed and all that. And... I did it for my mother. I want to tell the world what they did to me and my mother. And she did nothing wrong whatsoever. And the most annoying thing was going in and out to Merlin Park, to the option place, looking for the file. So eventually I got the file in. And then I was told in that if I got a death cert for my mother and my foster parents to bring it in, they had more information for me. And I couldn't understand why did they need the death certs for. And when I brought them in, then she told me, you have it all in your file. Couldn't understand this at all. So then anyways, I got a phone call again saying that they had 2 possible fathers' name in there. But they were written in red underneath, not saying that they were. So apparently this one went on holidays then. And we had to fill out a form again, the whole lot, sent off to Tushla. She said, you should know within 3 months. I rang them. They got nothing at all from Mellon Park. I rang her. I sent it. This is the crack that was going on. So eventually, she went off on holidays and this man got on the phone to me, asked me, are you Patrick Joseph Haverty? I said, yes, I have information here. He said, for you. Will you take it over the phone? I said, I will. And his 2 names here are possible fathers. So I went searching then to find out and then Kathleen Corliss told me then to come down to the house. That we can put you up in the database, put a spit into the thing and send it off.
Mm.
And next thing, father's name comes up.
From your DNA?
From my DNA. I found out I had a cousin in America. Then I found I had cousins here as well in Ireland that didn't know anything at all about.
Wow.
So I went looking in for the father and all that and cannot trace him anywhere. Cannot be found.
Okay.
Whether he went to America or where he went to.
You have no information on him?
No traceability at all of him.
How's that make you feel, not knowing?
Well, it's kind of angry in a way because you'd love to have met him.
Yeah.
And just find out why. Now, it could be his own family said keep away from her. There was a lot of that as well. And you had a lot of things as well where men were put into Bannisloe home because they fell in love with a girl and the families didn't like it. She's not good enough for you. A lot of this went on. And then the main thing was, the most annoying thing was the drugs. Drugs was used, lucky enough, I don't think it was in Joan, but there was drugs used in Bannisloe and there was drugs used on babies, trial drugs by companies. to see what effect or what the baby before they put them on the market. And that did happen.
On babies, the babies?
On babies. There was drugs tried done on babies.
Like babies like you?
Like me now, but I wasn't.
There was no mom and dad.
They had no mom, you see, so the nuns walk away, they were okay.
The nuns allowed it.
Who's going to know anyways? So the drugs were used. So the drug company, there's a row going on now between the nuns and the church, or the drug companies and the church now, because they don't want to pay out compensation to the people that the drugs were used on, because one is blaming the other. So this thing now is going on at the moment.
Wow. I didn't know about that.
So they were all guinea pigs. The babies were guinea pigs. Bandislaw was a haven there for drugs, trying out drugs.
And then you wonder about babies dying. we don't know what they died from, do we?
That's like, a lot of them said they died from measles, they died from this, they died from that.
But they could write whatever they wanted, right?
Well, sure, that's the thing.
There was no official, anyone checking what they died from.
There was no one checking anything.
They could have choked, they could have been bit. You don't know what happened.
Nobody knows. That's the thing. It's sad. Very, very sad.
It's horrific.
And the most annoying thing, like, you know, is a Catholic country of ours. Saints and scholars. Beautiful country. Beautiful people.
Yeah.
And here, you had all this going on.
I know.
Undercover.
They had a great marketing team for the country. The most mystical, magical land. And it was so dark.
I said the drugs company were delighted.
Yeah.
That they could use these drugs on and nobody know anything. It'll never come back to them.
So I suppose for you, I'm just interested to hear about, you know, right now, your whole life, I suppose, was overshadowed by this. I'm sure you had a lovely life, no more than what that woman says. You had a gorgeous wife and
gorgeous
kids.
Gorgeous wife and kids and grandkids. I am blessed, like, as I said to the minister when he was down there, O'Gorman, and I thanked him for coming down, and I said, "You're standing on babies." And he looked at me, he thought I was a screw loose or something. And he said, "There, they're under your feet there," I said. And I said, "You're very lucky you're talking to me, because you could be standing on me." And I said, "I was one of the lucky ones that got out of here, got to a good foster home, and was able to meet my mother and be to go to her funeral. And then to be able to get married." Married was a big thing that time. I was going with girls and parents, keep away from him.
Really?
Oh yeah. You don't know where he is. You know what disease he's carrying. The dirt that was thrown at me growing up was unreal.
Like what? Abuse from other...
I was told that I was a bastard, dirt from the street, a disease carrier. And the big thing was being a queer. For some reason or other, I don't know why that. And only if you were taken in, you'd be begging off the streets. Everything was thrown at you, and the art stopped. It was awful growing up. At the finish, you'd be so shy, you'd be trying to avoid people. You didn't want to meet people. It was so bad what you were called like. And then you go with girls, then the next thing parents hear about, keep away from that lad. And that was the way it was. And it was very hard. I didn't think I'd ever, ever be married or have a family and to have grandkids. I never thought that would ever happen to me. But thanks be to God, I did meet a good lady that accepted me for who I was. The parents accepted me for who I was. And we got married.
Tell me what it was like becoming a dad, knowing.
Imagine, yeah, becoming a dad and a granddad.
I know.
Even my grandkid now, he's 6 years of age and he wants me to play football with him. I got two knees replaced, like, you know. There's only so much you can take. So I said, "We'll go in and have a cup of tea." Sat down. No length of time sitting up. "Come on, granddad," pulled me. "You know what's wrong with you, granddad? You're an old man." I said, "Thank you very much." Oh. Nice compliment. But that's the beauty, like, of that's course. The enjoyment.
But when you look at your grandchild, is it a boy or girl?
Two boys and a girl.
When you look at them and know that you were that age.
Yeah.
And that you were locked up in this prison.
And see.
How does that make you feel? Must be awful.
To see the love and care they're getting now.
Mm, that you didn't get.
And to think that I called it a prison in Joma, I didn't call it home.
Yeah.
I always said it was a prison. And to think that I was locked up there 7 years of my life. No love, no care, nothing, and see what they're getting. And the beauty about it is, I think one good thing for me, out of the whole lot of it. I'm very close with my three sons and very close to the three grandkids and to my wife. I think that was one good gift that I got.
That
I showed that love and that showed that care. Because I remember when I went to the priest there, when I was collecting money for the ground down there, and I went into the priest and I told him, he said, "You're going down a very dangerous road," he said. "And you'll go down there and you get confused and you neglect your wife and your kids." And I said, "No, Father," I said, "you did that with my mother." I said, I won't do that. That will never happen to me." And I walked away from him. That's what I said to him.
So. And in spite of it all, you understand how much a child needs love.
That's the, you know, as I say, like you, the mother carries the child for 9 months and it brings it into the world. And the enjoyment of seeing that baby and that baby to be whipped away from her. Like when my three sons, when they were born, Lord God, I was over the moon. I was over the moon and think, my God, I'm a father. I have a son. The thing, and I could do and show love and show and play with it and do everything with it. And to think at that age, I was locked in a prison, confined to an old building and the whole lot, and going around there brainless, not knowing anything. You know, it angers me. And there's another thing I want to say as well. Anybody that's out there that's were abused, sexually abused, beaten or anything, I want them to come forward and tell their story. Don't bring it to the grave with you. It's no good. And they will find great relief and great weight off their shoulder. And they will give them that courage. Like Catherine Corley said to me, if she didn't use that word to me and if I didn't meet her, I'd be still with me head down. And I'm asking them to come forward. Don't be ashamed. Don't be embarrassed. There's help there. That is a fact.
Yeah.
There's no question about it.
You know, it's just, it's so upsetting to think of how you started off in your life, but you're such a wonderful man. You're so full of love. You're able. And even though you carry anger.
I carry, and as you, I said, I will carry that to the grave.
I don't see it in you though.
I know, but.
But is it all internal? Still,
it's internal.
So do you feel like you still suffer inside?
I do. And the fact that these nuns, like Indy Kinney annoyed me so much when he stood up in the door, apologising to us, and had written out to him. And when I was asked that about the apology, I said, I don't accept that apology.
Yeah.
If you want to apologise to somebody, you'll meet them face to face and look them in the eyes.
Yeah.
And say, we're sorry. He couldn't come down to Chum and come into us. We had a group. And he couldn't walk into that group and say, I'm here now on behalf of the state and the government. And I'm apologising to each and every one of ye I see around here. That was never done.
It would mean a lot in terms of the anger that you carry.
It would mean a lot. But just standing up in front of a camera and to the world media and a half pretending to be broken hearted. Like, they sent us up to Dublin to the Commission of Investigation. Three of them. They hadn't a smile on their face. They frightened you nearly. Like, what are you coming here for?
No compassion. Say.
No compassion at all. This girl now is taping you. This girl is writing down what you're saying.
Okay.
And then to get the feedback from within and say every mother could take their babies if they wanted to. And that's another person I'd love to thank is Sarah Ann Buckley in the University in Galway. Wonderful history. And she brought us all in there and took all our stories and is archived in there now. And now it's going out to the secondary schools in September. It's going to be part of history now. And it's going to be in the junior exams.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And that's amazing. And I hope the kids will absorb what went on. And if they come nurses, teachers, doctors, or whatever may be, that they will recognise a child being something wrong. There's something wrong with that child. I better check in on him because that child could be treated badly at home. You know, and that he's been bullied or something like that. That this will be a big help to them.
Yeah, that's why it's invaluable, the stories of all these survivors, what they could teach.
What they could teach. Like, it's still going on today, the bullying of kids and beating of kids. It's still going on.
Abuse, everything's happening.
It's still going on. And I hope when these students move on earlier in life, whatever they take up in life, that they'll recognise there's something wrong with that child. Because that's how that teacher recognised that boy in the tech. And the foster parents took him in and he was being brutally treated at home at the foster home. And that's how sharp that teacher was to spot that.
Yeah.
And that was back in the 60s.
Yeah.
You know?
When there was no sort of awareness of anything.
Nothing, yeah.
What do you hope to happen, I suppose, with the site in Tuam where you started your life and where those remains of the babies?
Well, I'm hoping that, you know, people say leave them there, but how do you leave somebody in a sewer tank's remains? It doesn't matter. But like your people out there, like said that woman, 93 years of age, you have survivors there as well. They have sisters and brothers in there. And wouldn't it be lovely to know, even, I know it's a sad way of putting it, they're dead, but at least if the remains are there, that they can take them home.
Yeah.
And give them a dignified Christian burial.
Yeah.
Because they were Catholics, they were baptized.
Yeah.
And they give them a dignified, and it would be an end. It would be something.
Yeah.
For them. And that's what I would love to see, because no matter what child is missing or something, people, parents would love to know where they are.
Yeah.
If they were kidnapped after something, you still do everything you can.
So there's still parents out there and brothers and sisters and families and nieces and nephews of these babies.
Of these babies, yeah. And the thing that annoys me then, they're not allowing cousins to do DNA. For some reason, I don't know why. Because they could match up, because maybe the sisters and the brothers could be dead, but they might have a cousin.
Yeah.
And at least, but apparently, what, I don't know why they won't allow it. And it should be allowed. So it should. Definitely.
It's a huge stain on the powers that be in this country, isn't it?
It's still the same.
But it's not being, you know, when things are like shameful like that.
Yeah.
And you just ignore it. It doesn't go away.
It doesn't.
You have to, someone somewhere has to stand up and give their full committal that this will be seen all the way through. Whatever it takes.
It takes, yeah.
And that's not happening, it's really.
It's not happening.
A few statements here and there just to try and get you all to go away.
Yeah, try. And the sad thing about it, our age, and the longer this goes on, some of them are going to be passed away, because a lot of our friends have passed away. And I love to pass on my condolence to their families.
Yeah.
That we knew, that were in the home with us.
Yeah.
And they have passed on. We're lucky we're still alive. So I'd just like to pass on my condolence to them. And as well as that, like, you know, I don't blame all priests or all nuns.
Yeah.
I got attacked in a pub one night a couple of years ago. And this man had an aunt in London. And the cheek of me and everything, the whole lot of it. Oh. So I said, look it. I said, they don't highlight that. They say nuns and priests. But I said, look it, there's good nuns out there. They suffered.
Yeah.
There's priests out there that suffered. But I said, it's the power at the top again.
Yeah, it's the organisation you're talking about.
They're the ones at the very top that caused the problem.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I'd like to help anyone, if I can at all, anything at all, I'd love to do it. Because I know what it's like, you know.
Yeah.
And the people that I met through industrial schools, if these people that's calling us names, still calling us names, if they were to listen to their stories. And it's not my fault, as Kathleen Corliss says.
Of course it's not.
It's not mine, and I didn't create the problem.
Not whatsoever.
So why should I have to suffer, and my mother suffering?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, we shouldn't.
No.
And if these people had the decency, but they won't admit it, because if they do, they're guilty.
And it's money too, isn't it?
It's money again.
Yeah, if they accept fault, they can be like sued.
People come along, oh, you made a fortune. You got your redress. I said, yeah, but damn all of it. Yeah. And I said, you know what I got?
Yeah.
I got some of my money that my mother paid into the nuns.
Yeah.
That's the redress I
got. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The 5 she paid every month.
Mm-hmm.
That's what she paid. So,
In terms of, I suppose, your life now, and when you look back and stuff, I know you say you're full of anger and things like that. And just kind of to finish on your grief for your mom, do you feel still that you were robbed of, regardless, I know your mom is your foster mom.
I know.
Your birth mother. Do you feel like with your birth mother, do you still feel that sense of that you were robbed of a life of being reared by your mother?
I really do.
Do you grieve that?
I do. And I get annoyed so much is what they did to the two of us.
Yeah.
And they could have kept the two of us together. Now, I have a file there which I got, not realising that I was going to be sold to a family in Rhode Island.
And how did you find that
out? And my mother didn't know. The file we got, I got in Menlyn Park when the government said, right, they were forced. They want to lock them up for 30 years, the government.
The files?
The files, 30 years.
Yes,
to lock them up for 30 years.
Yes,
till fair dues to Sinn Féin, Mary Lou and Europe and the whole lot.
Got them
said
out.
No, and next thing the law was passed, they had to hand them out to us. And that's when I realised that I was on my way to a family in Rhode Island.
What stopped that happening?
Because apparently the family had to be checked out more. Plus the fact then when they did pick me out to go to America, they wanted a girl. And before 53, they were sending boys and girls. We'd say a couple in America wanted a boy and a girl before 53. And what they would do then, they pick out a boy and they pick out a girl. And they would pass them off as brothers and sisters.
And they weren't at all?
They weren't at all, no.
Jesus Christ.
So the law changed in 1953 then. It had to be a brother and sister that was allowed to go to these families in America.
So you were no good to them because you had no sister?
Well, they were looking for the girl then. They couldn't get a girl, you see, in the whole lot. And it was dragging and dragging and dragging. And next thing they gave up altogether then. My photograph is in there. My passport photograph is in there. So it is. That I was off to America. So it all fell through.
You saw that picture?
It's there in the file. My passport picture's in the file.
Was that the first time you'd ever seen a picture
of yourself? That's the first time I ever seen a picture of myself.
What did you think when you saw that?
I nearly got shocked. Everybody's laughing at me because I'm so serious on it. You know, they're just funny side, but then they're said into thing that that's what they were doing. Like, you know.
And that picture was taken by the nuns?
The guards. The girls were involved.
But you were in
it.
The care
of the nuns, yeah.
At that time.
And the girls were involved with that.
So they would have brought you to take that picture?
Yeah, they got £3.11 or something for organising at the girls. It's all in there. And the letter of my mother sending back is all in there. So this was a money-making machine, like. Like, we're exporting stock out to Europe and these places. They were exporting babies back in them days. And then putting the mothers into laundries.
Are you glad that didn't happen, that you didn't end up in America?
I'm glad because, like, I wouldn't have known anything.
Yeah.
Because I'd have grown up thinking they were my mother and father, and if they passed away, I think, yeah. Now, the big problem would be there, as somebody said, if you went into hospital and you needed something and they say, like, you know, oh, he's a sister, surely we'd be able to. And then they go looking up and say, geez, they don't have the same DNA. What's here?
Yeah, yeah.
This doesn't sound right.
Yeah.
And that's the only way you'd.
Does it give you comfort, you know, that memory you have of your mom in your birth mother in the car smiling at you?
It does.
Knowing that she fighting to get to you.
But it's amazing how it clicked in my mind.
Yeah.
That's what I can't get over. Like, you know, sometimes you forget. I think the reason it clicked in my mind, I was worried about it.
Yeah.
That I had the cows let out in front of them or something and they were going to come down to tell the foster parents how dangerous he is. And I think that's the way it stayed in my mind.
But she told you that when she met you?
She told me when I met her then.
What did she say? You were bringing cows across the road?
I bring cows across the road. She said, you remember, and the two in the car.
And you said, yeah, I remember.
I remember that, I said. And I said, I was afraid. I didn't know. Did I let the cows out in front? Were you going to?
And that was her coming to
see
you?
That was her. But she couldn't say anything because she has been warned.
That's so heartbreaking, isn't it?
Yeah, it was so. And thinking, going to the priest, thinking the priest might have helped her.
No chance.
And then have to go to England thinking, this is it. Never see me again. Good luck. That's it.
Vijay, it's a powerful story. And, you know, I'm sure that inside you have a world of pain still. But I'm sure it helps to talk.
Well, it does. It's helped. And as I said, back to Kathleen Corliss, like, it did help.
Yeah.
Fair play to her.
Yeah.
Because I'd be going around with that anger inside. Like, I know it's still a set, but at least
some of it has dissipated.
Dissipated
maybe.
And gone, and I was there to tell it.
Yeah, and own it.
And, you know, and that's the beauty about it.
And remove
it.
The shame from yourself and give it to someone
else. Well, I could
else.
Walk, she said you could walk out with your head held up high because you did nothing wrong.
Nothing. Not a thing.
Because I'd be going around there with my head down thinking, oh yes, I'm guilty as well.
But that's from years of people telling you that you were
well, people telling
less
you,
than.
Yeah, that you're this, you're that. And,
yeah.
You know, I remember going to a first dance. I went to a first dance there and to my foster mother was trying to push me out like, because I was so afraid and nervous. So eventually I went and paid my money in and went up to the band, looking at the band, and then I used to get taps on the shoulders in. And it was from fellas. Do you want to dance? That's the fact. That isn't the word a lie.
Why? Joking.
I was classified being gay. Queer.
And were they doing it for a skit? Like
a skit. Oh, they'll have a big skit of laughing and everything. That's a
because
fact.
Because they knew you came from that home.
They knew that I was out of a home, that I was born out of wedlock. Even the cell, they didn't have to know you came out of home, but once you were born out of wedlock. That's how strong the church was, the religion was. And like sure, the religion was beaten into in the national school, like. And you didn't question religion.
No.
You just accepted it and this was it.
It's amazing how much has changed, isn't it, in a short time?
In a short time.
Yeah. Like, it's weird that I'm the next generation to you. Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? My dad was born in 1956, or 53.
Yeah.
So I'm the next generation.
That's, yeah.
And I had a child out of wedlock.
Yeah.
You know, and I christened him and my priest welcomed me.
Yeah.
And my child is adored. And then I got married.
That's
no problem.
No problem.
To think that it's just one generation.
And
how much has changed, you know?
Even married women back in then, this was, I couldn't get my head around it. Had to go to the church to be cleansed before they could have their baby baptized.
Oh, really?
And I couldn't get, and it was this, she had to wait outside the church. It could be raining. She couldn't go into the church before the priest. She had to go into the rear of the church. And he come down with the book then and open it out. Get rid of all your sins and everything and all this and everything. She was married and she had a baby. So what? Now he said you can attend the...
And come here, the man wasn't cleansed, was
no,
he?
No, that's the... that was the one thing that maddened me. And this all stems from Adam and Eve. That's where all that stemmed from. This Adam and Eve business. Because I have no problem with women becoming priests. I have no problem. I would go into a church if there's a woman. I'd have no problem. But you have Rome there that's red rotten. The men all wants the power out there. They don't want any women having powers. Even the cell, the women do all the work in the church. Like that's the amazing thing about the whole lot of it. And why can they not come a priest? If they want to, give them the choice, and they should be.
You've said that before about even, you know, the fact that it was the woman that was locked up and she was at fault and it was never the man.
Never the man. He got away. He got married. He had a great life.
Isn't it crazy?
You know, maybe my father went off there, got married, and had a great life.
Yeah, it's nothing that he did wrong. He got involved with the wrong woman.
Yeah, and there's my mother, and there's the laundries. There's Bandislaw, St. Bridges.
I know.
The people that were put in there, there was nothing wrong with them. All they needed was help from a doctor thing. It was easier to throw them in there and try drugs on them, and that was it. Because some of them might be, you know, we often see today now, kids that be hyper.
Yeah.
Down syndrome, there might be something there, and then, you know, and all they needed was just care or something. But instead, that was handed to use the drugs.
Yeah, and lock them up.
Lock them up. That's one way of solving problems.
PJ, thank you so much for coming in today.
Yeah.
I have learned so much from you, and I think that you are a phenomenal man, and that you may keep using that voice because you are just inspirational in that you're able to uncover those secrets and help people, you know, to understand that they've nothing
to be ashamed
to carry
of.
Or to be ashamed of.
Nothing,
you know, and to say loudly that what happened was wrong.
And as I say, there, people that's out there, come forward.
Yeah.
Don't keep your head down like I did.
Yeah.
There's people out there will help you and tell your story. Don't be embarrassed.
Yeah. Thank you, PJ. Yeah.
I want to thank you as well for giving us the space and time as well to hear all this as well, like, you know. Thank you very much for it.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thanks, PJ.
Thanks.